Welcome to the Delmarva Almanac. Each week we connect you to the best of Delmarva. I'm your host, Dana Kester McCabe. This week we'll meet artist Hannibal Lee, who translates paint into fabric. We'll hear the story of World War II POW camps here on Delmarva, and naturalist Dave Wilson shares his conversation about coyotes on Delmarva with Dr. Aaron Hoag. Hannibal Lee is a painter living in Nanticoke with a studio in Salisbury. He was born and raised on his grandmother's farm near the DuPont family steeplechases around Fair Hill, Maryland. This led him to an early love of animals. His family encouraged him to follow his creative pursuits as a youngster. Hannibal's father worked for the Curtis Paper Company, which specialized in custom high-grade papers used for such prestigious projects as the White House's Christmas cards. One of his father's co-workers at the paper plant gave him a tip that led to Hannibal's having an auspicious teacher. Here is Hannibal Lee.
One of the fellows there, he was with the shopkeepers that, you know, repaired the machinery or kept it running. And he said to me, he says, have you heard of Andrew Wyeth? And I said, yeah, I guess. And he says, oh, come on. And he says, Andrew Wyeth and Chaz Ford. And I said, all right. And he says, I understand his sister, Carolyn Wyeth, is taking students for painting lessons. So I packed up the car with my portfolio, unannounced and uninvited, and went up and knocked on Carolyn Wyeth's door. Well, it was a very rainy morning, and she had 10 dogs, hybrid dogs, poodles, and dogs she had rescued from the pound. So she comes out and jumps in my new car with all these muddy dogs following behind me, and she's telling them to get in the GD car. We're going up to my father's studio. So we went up to NCY's studio, which is a beautiful building on the hillside, and I believe it's open to the public now. So she looked at my portfolio, and she said, yes, I'll take you as a student. She said, but you have some kind of special abilities. So I became a private student with her, and we became friends. So, and when we were in Port Clyde, Maine, she says, let's go over and visit Andy. She said, I want him to see your work. Well, he went through my oils and watercolors, and he said, yeah, I said, I really like these oils. He says, they have a lot of Edward Hopper influence. And I said, oh, I said, God, I hate his work. I didn't like Edward Hopper's work. And he says, wait a minute. He says, he's one of the best American contemporary artists that we have. Well, of course, I had opened my foot, I mean mouth, and inserted my foot. So I learned a lesson from that, not to be so outspoken. Well, maybe I didn't learn a lesson.
After working in oils and watercolors for some time, a friend offered him a stash of textile remnants in case he wanted to find a creative use for them.
He was working for the Schumacher Company, and you know they do fine, upper-grade fabrics. So he had brought some discarded fabrics home to his wife, and they asked me if I wanted some. So on a whim, I made a picture, a side view of a 1920 Rolls-Royce with the driver up front, the chauffeur with his handlebar mustache and a duster, and out of the back window of the Rolls, I had this lion waving. What was just whimsical and put together, very primitive with all these fabrics. So this fella had a gallery on the Kennet Pike, and he said, why don't we try 20 of these? Make up some whimsical ones, because he was selling my oils and watercolors. So I made up 20 cats and canopy beds and frogs and praying mantises and all these kind of things and peacocks. So on the second night of the show, we had sold 16 out of 20. Well, anyway, that put me on my way of making pictures with textiles. And then I had people who wanted commissioned pictures made. So I did that. I went on and made pictures for different people of commissioned pieces, for Mrs. Carpenter in Wilmington, you know, for Mrs. Lickle. And as I made them, I learned how to make them better.
Hannibal became intrigued with the history of tapestries as an art form, and he began to reproduce famous tapestries using his newfound medium. He makes drawing maps of his designs and then cuts out each area of color in a corresponding fabric. The result is a combination of collage and bas-relief. These elaborate works of art look representational from a distance, but up close they are a celebration of hue, texture, and textile patterns. Their three-dimensionality adds another layer of interest for the viewer.
It's like when I build a great blue heron, it's like the actual feathers. With a lot of commission pieces, these grasses and artifacts, the barks, come from the patron's property, so it makes it a very personalized thing. For a while, I did not put them under glass, but people wanted to touch them. They were so, you know, intrigued by them. So I started putting them under glass, and now today they go under museum glass where you don't get any reflections of the pictures. And then I had a show in Harrisburg with Mary Kay Interiors, and there in Harrisburg, she placed 8 of my pictures with the Hershey Library, and I'm sure they're still on exhibition today. There's one of an actual size line that the picture's maybe 3 foot tall and 8 foot wide kind of thing.
Hannibal began to call his reproductions translations because they translated oils into fabric. But he did not just look to the ancient fiber arts. He began to study in depth the work of Vincent van Gogh, which did not necessarily meet with the approval of his mentor.
When Carolyn and I would be in the studio, we would have royal four-letter word battles that she thought he was worthless and I thought he was great. We would laugh about these kind of things. She was a fabulous, wonderful character. So anyway, you know, my intrigue with Van Gogh continued. And I have like maybe 65 to 70 books on Van Gogh. I've gone to all the art exhibitions. So, and I've read all 650 of his letters. Well, what happened, you know, along the way, being so enamored or so involved with Van Gogh's pictures and knowing, you know, what he did to produce his pictures. And he talks about, you know, collecting capes, bonnets, jackets. You know, he talks about, you know, the woodblock print being like crepe paper or crepe paper or whatever. All these things. And so along the way, I shifted off and I thought, I'm going to start doing his pictures in fabric. Because the bottom line is, how I'm saying now is, he translated fabrics into oil paint. And my tribute to him and his genius was to transplant his paintings back into fabrics.
A major project that Hannibal recently completed was 3 paintings that Vincent van Gogh wrote about in his letters to his brother Theo, who was an art dealer. The centerpiece was a portrait of a woman. Vincent had wanted this piece to hang with one of his sunflower paintings on either side. The original portrait still exists. Though many of his sunflower paintings do survive, those he had chosen for this arrangement were destroyed during World War II. After Vincent's death, Theo had sold the works separately. Hannibal talks about translating Vincent's original vision for the 3 paintings.
With this, I want Vincent's triptych resurrected. Mr. Walter Annenberg, who left his collection to the Philadelphia Museum of Art, owned Madame Rouleau. There are 5 versions of this, and I believe he bought the first version. The other 4 versions, her hands are reversed in the pictures. And he always wanted this triptych done. He did a letter to his brother with this design in, you know, of how he wanted these 3 pictures laid out. And he talks about putting orange lath strips around the sunflowers. Simplified. So that's why it has an orange border around it. And he talked about her having red, ordinary red painted lath strips. And it took 6 years to make this picture. It was the 125th anniversary of Vincent van Gogh's death last year. So I just want to give him credit for what he's done for the world and what I want to do for him.
Hannibal Lee says that with so many of Van Gogh's works held in private collections, he hopes his translations will end up in places where everyone can enjoy them. Hannibal recently had a show at the Ocean City Center for the Arts. Once completed, he hopes to bring the rest of his Van Gogh series back there. To see samples of his work in a video of this interview and get a link to his website, go to our website, delmarvaalmanac.com/arts. Let's take a little break before we go on to our next story, Delmarva's Prisoner of War Camps. Art strolls are definitely a habit worth forming. Every month, enjoy a great night out while supporting local artists and businesses. Galleries and shops stay open late. Opening receptions feature special gallery exhibits. Often there is free entertainment. Many of Delmarva's communities now have monthly art strolls. Visit our website so you can get in the art stroll habit. DelmarvaAlmanac.com/artstroll. This is the Delmarva Almanac. I'm Dana Kester McCabe, and I'm so glad you've joined us today. As I watch the weekly migration of tourists flocking to our shorelines for vacation, I'm reminded of some not-so-willing visitors to our beautiful peninsula. I'm not talking about recalcitrant teenagers who would rather do anything than be cooped up in a car or a small hotel room with their loving but annoying family. I'm referring to World War II prisoners of war. During the war years, there was a labor shortage throughout the country with so many young men serving in the armed forces around the world. A lot of young women had also signed up for service that took them away from home or their farming chores. Produce from farms back here in the States was desperately needed not only to feed people at home, but for our troops abroad. So, as the military began to capture enemy prisoners, they were shipped back here to help out. On Delmarva, they delivered mostly German and Italian soldiers captured in North Africa. By the end of the war, there were over 500 POW camps on U.S. soil, housing over 425,000 prisoners. Here on Delmarva, they were located all over the peninsula. In Delaware, there were camps in Bethany Beach, Bridgeville, Georgetown, Harrington, Leipsic, Lewis, and Slaughter Beach. On Maryland's eastern shore, there were camps in Berlin, Cambridge, Church Hill, Easton, Hurlock, and Westover. And on Virginia's eastern shore, there was a camp in Oyster near Cape Charles. Once here, the POWs lived in simple accommodations that reflected the rules of the Geneva Convention of 1929. The barracks generally had indoor plumbing and day rooms with German language books and magazines. There were usually rudimentary sports fields where the men could play soccer. One account says they were fed peanut butter sandwiches twice a day and given milk in the evening. But by and large, records show that they usually ate 3 square meals a day. One story tells of a summer treat they were given here of corn on the cob. This was met with great dismay by the Germans, who had never seen corn used for anything other than feeding livestock. They wondered if they were being punished until they tried it. One beer a day was included as part of their rations. And though fraternization was strictly against the rules, prisoners and their bosses or co-workers would, from time to time, enjoy a good party together over a few beers. One group of prisoners being transported back to camp during a hurricane in 1944 had to seek refuge at a Whaleyville farm where they were welcomed in. They entertained their hosts singing German folk songs till the storm quit blowing. Prisoners worked in Delmarva's lumber mills, farm fields, orchards, canneries, and poultry processing plants. They repaired the boardwalk in Rehoboth Beach. Some were brought to Dover Airfield to do heavy lifting and other chores. You're listening to the Delmarva Almanac. I'm Dana Kester McCabe, and this is the story of World War II POW camps on Delmarva. In Somerset County, farmers and businesses paid 8 cents a day per laborer. Prisoners could keep some of the money to spend on cigarettes and sundries. Employers paid the rest of the money directly to the government. In Delaware alone, $2.4 million was raised to support the war with this program. This also did a lot to help the local economy. For example, in Somerset County, annual farm profits during the Depression years of the 1930s averaged around $1.5 million. The county was now making $6 million annually. The Maryland tomato harvest of 1945 was said to have been saved by the POW initiative. Some employers hired out their workers for more money to other people, sort of like subletting an apartment. They gave the prisoners extra rations and other perks and took their profits under the table. Even though this was strictly against the rules, everybody seemed happy with the arrangement and kept it to themselves. Many local farmers became so fond of their workers, they wanted them to stay here once peace broke out. And it was not uncommon for prisoners to have mutual feelings. They were not political for the most part and had no real grudge against the Americans. Some had been pressed into military service against their will to begin with. Over time, the prisoners earned more and more trust, and in many places they were only lightly guarded. POWs were often seen on the streets of Milford, enjoying day passes given as a reward for good behavior. In Bethany Beach, they had teenage volunteers guarding the prisoners while they were out on work detail. One boy, Raymond Deputy, began guarding at the ripe old age of 14. His only weapon was a 12-gauge shotgun with a single cartridge in it. In some parts of the country, camps near colleges allowed prisoners to take classes while they were here. But things didn't go smoothly at every camp. Dedicated Nazis had to be quarantined in their own barracks so they would not harm their less zealous comrades after some were injured or died in fights that broke out. Some POWs were killed while trying to escape. Across the bay at Fort Meade, 5 prisoners committed suicide when victory over Germany was declared. At the camp in Westover, several men tried to escape after learning that they were to be sent back to their homes in a region of Germany that was now controlled by the Russians. By 1946, all the prisoners of war held in the United States had been repatriated. There are many stories of former POWs returning to Delmarva to see the place where they had waited out the end of the war. They were grateful for the good treatment they received here and happy to reconnect with the families they had worked for. We should not make light of the fact that they were forced to labor against their will, even if their work fell within the rules of the Geneva Convention. But like many of our seasonal workers in the tourism industry today, they stayed here for a brief time, worked hard, and went home with stories of Eastern Shore hospitality. The big difference is they arrived as enemies and left as friends. I'd call that a bit of Delmarva magic. If you would like to learn more about Delmarva heritage and this story, visit our website, delmarvaalmanac.com/history. And now for some Delmarva dates with history for this time period. On July 27, 1920, the first Delaware State Fair was held in Harrington, Delaware. And 5 years later on that day, the first Chincoteague Pony Penning, as we know it, was held. Livestock auctions and country fairs had been held on Delmarva beaches for more than a century prior to this event, but this Chincoteague tradition is the only one like it that continues to this day. This Wednesday and Thursday, as a matter of fact. That's when the famous herd of island horses are brought across the island bay so yearling foals can be culled and sold to benefit the local volunteer fire company. You can enjoy the spectacle along with their carnival through the end of the week. This is also the last week of this year's Delaware State Fair in Harrington. They have farm exhibits, 4-H competitions, carnival rides, concerts, and more. But those aren't the only festivals you can go to this week. Next weekend, July 29th through the 31st, is the Somerset County Fair, held at the Civic Center in Princess Anne. Also next weekend in Ocean City is the annual Greek Festival at the Convention Center. Festival goers can enjoy authentic traditional Greek music, dancing, and cuisine. And for another chance to enjoy a down-home country fair, August 5th through the 7th is the Worcester County Fair at Bird Park in Snow Hill. Find links for these and lots of other events happening this summer on our website, delmarvaalmanac.com/events. It's time for another break. When we come back, we'll hear about coyotes on Delmarva. Did you know that according to the USDA, 14% of American households did not have a sufficient quantity of affordable, nutritious food for at least part of 2014? Please consider giving generously to your local food bank regularly throughout the year. Visit our website for links for your state, delmarvaalmanac.com/hunger. Welcome back to the Delmarva Almanac. Now here's naturalist Dave Wilson and his guest, Dr. Aaron Hoag, to tell us about coyotes.
Dr. Hoag returns today for the second part of a 2-part series on the loss of predators on the Delmarva Peninsula. Today we'll discuss the status of coyotes here. Dr. Hoag is a biology professor at Salisbury University, where he has worked for the past 11 years. He holds a PhD in evolutionary biology from Northwestern University in Chicago. His specialties are in mammalogy and evolution, and he's done extensive research studying the nexus between human activities, terrestrial habitat destruction, and species declines. Today I want to continue our discussion about the loss of mammalian predators by focusing on coyotes. First, Dr. Hogue, do we have a sense of the status of coyotes on the Eastern Shore?
Yes. In the on the Eastern Shore in the state of Maryland, Maryland DNR considers them to be present in every county. Delaware, DNREC, has stated that they are established in the state of Delaware, which means they're probably found in all or most counties of Delaware. In Virginia, there are records of them from Accomack County, and they are also present on islands at the southern tip of the peninsula, so they're probably essentially peninsula-wide.
Are these coyotes the same as western coyotes? I know coyotes aren't necessarily native to the East Coast. And how big are they, or is there any work on their DNA?
There is a single species of coyote in North America. When Europeans first arrived in North America, there's some controversy about the distribution of that species as well as other members of the genus Canis. But it appears that coyote were found largely in the central part of North America, and other species of Canis, including gray wolves and possibly red and or eastern wolves, were found to the north and in the eastern part of the continent. The persecution and eventual extirpation of wolves in the eastern United States essentially created a vacuum that the coyote then were able to fill. And so what ended up happening is coyote began to move eastward. And there's some question about exactly how that happened and when it happened. But it looks like they spread east in two waves, a northern wave that occurred probably earlier, starting in the early 1900s, and then a southern wave that started a little bit later. In both cases, they periodically encountered some of the remaining wolves and interbred with them. They also encountered domestic dogs and interbred with them. What ended up happening for our region, those two waves in the north and south eventually converged in the mid-Atlantic. The earliest record I have of coyote in on the eastern shore, on the peninsula, is from 1921. In Kent County, and that suggests that they, the local coyote, the coyote on Delmarva, are probably from that northern wave, since it was early in the 1900s. In any case, if you look at the DNA of eastern coyote, what you will find is there are very few that are pure coyote. Most of them contain some amount of wolf and dog DNA, roughly around 10%. So what that means morphologically is that coyote are typically somewhere, eastern coyote are somewhat intermediate between western coyote and wolves. They tend to be larger. I think western coyote are around 20 to 30 pounds on average, whereas eastern coyote are a little bit larger in the range of 30 to 40 pounds, which is still nowhere near the size of gray wolves, which are sometimes around three times as large as western coyote.
What are these species eating on the shore?
There aren't any studies, to my knowledge, of what they're actually eating. Coyote, throughout their range, vary their diet based on what other species are present and also seasonally. So in many parts of the country, during the summer, they're pretty omnivorous. So they'll eat berries, a lot of small mammals and other small vertebrates. In the wintertime, when a lot of those resources become less available, they start to shift to larger mammals, including deer. There is evidence that they not only eat deer, but actually will even take down mostly sick or injured adult deer. But they also scavenge pretty heavily on carcasses of deer that either died on their own or from from roadkills.
What's the sense of their impact on biodiversity on the Eastern Shore?
With the lack of any large predators, they very likely probably fill a role somewhere intermediate between something like a cougar or a wolf and smaller carnivores. And so they probably are still somewhat omnivorous in the summer. They're still taking larger mammals in the winter and deer fawn in the spring, which means that they are serving a role in regulating those populations. And from an ecological perspective, the fact that white-tailed deer are so abundant on the Eastern Shore and have such dramatic effects on vegetation and then ultimately on other vertebrates that depend on that vegetation, they play an important ecological role, potentially, in minimizing that negative impact of deer and potentially some of the mesocarnivores, the mid-sized carnivores, by feeding on them, taking out fox and other mid-sized predators, including cats. That also very likely is performing an ecological service in minimizing their impact on small vertebrates, particularly breeding birds.
So how are they managed by the state? Are coyotes protected in any way, or do you feel the state might do a better job of managing coyotes? I know as a kid growing up watching Little Red Riding Hood and hearing all these stories, I have the sense that people think coyotes are dangerous to people. Is this a myth, or is there some truth to this? Can you elaborate on that?
They don't pose a danger to children. They do, however, pose a danger to cats that are running free. They in areas where coyote occur and have been studied and their diet analyzed, domestic cats often comprise part of their diet. From someone's perspective that has an outdoor cat, that is obviously a concern. But if you step back and look at the devastating impact that cats have on songbird populations, they shouldn't be out of the house to begin with. And so the fact that coyote are actually controlling those populations is performing an ecological service, allowing some of those birds to survive and other small mammals to survive and perform the ecological roles that they're supposed to perform.
We've been talking to Dr. Aaron Hoag from Salisbury University. For more information on apex predators, coyotes, and other species on the Eastern Shore, you can go to delmarvaalmanac.com/nature.
Thanks, Dave.
Well, that's all for this edition of the Delmarva Almanac. Be sure to follow us on Facebook or Twitter, and next week join us to learn more about our local culture and get connected to our natural wonders. We'd like to thank our community partners, the Friends of Delmarva Public Radio, and our underwriters for their help in bringing this program to you, our audience. If you'd like to become an underwriter for this program, visit delmarvaalmanac.com/support. Our theme music was provided by Brightside Studio. This show has been a Moonshell production. Thanks for listening. Until we meet again, may the rhythms and tides of Delmarva bring you good fortune.